Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. This hour, what young men have to say about sex, and it's more nuanced than you think. Peggy Ornstein expected that her conversations with young men about sex and masculinity would take some prodding. After all, as she notes in her new book, she could be their mother or a favorite aunt, and guys really aren't known for their introspective chattiness about much of anything. And yet Peggy found young men who were eager to discuss this most intimate part of their lives. They confided their insecurities, pressures, and pain, she writes, their anxieties about sexual performance, their desire to connect, and their fears about doing so. Today, a conversation with Peggy Ornstein about what she learned and how it fits with what you know and have experienced. I'd love to hear from the men in our audience who are, let's say, 30 years old and younger. Did your parents talk to you about sex and pleasure and love? How did you figure out what to believe? So for men listening this morning, 35, 30 years old and younger, I'd like to know what your parents said to you about sexual intimacy and pleasure. And parents of boys and young men, do you talk to your kids about sex and intimacy? Level with me and Peggy, because a lot of parents don't. How do those conversations go? Do you find that your kids are a little squirmy and you back off? What are these discussions with your young kids, particularly for this conversation, your young men, about sexual pleasure and intimacy? What are they like? How do they start? Here's the phone number, 651-227-6000. 800-242-2828, on Twitter, at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. As you can tell from the introduction, this is an adult conversation about sexuality and intimacy, and if that makes you uncomfortable, you may want to skip it. Peggy Ornstein is with us. She's the author of many books, including Girls and Sex. Her new book is titled Boys and Sex, Young Men on Hookups, Love, Porn, Consent, and Navigating the New Masculinity. And she's with us today from Washington. Peggy, congratulations on the book, and really great to have you back on the show.
It's so great to be here. I miss Minnesota.
Well, and we miss you, but we have you via studio. I have to go.
And I'm coming.
Okay, so when's your, want to talk about a book event real quick?
If I may, real quick. Yeah, I'm going to be doing an event in Minnesota, in Minneapolis, on January 15th. You can get details at Majors and Quinn, but we're doing it at the Solar Arts Building in Northeast Minnesota, Minneapolis, and taping the podcast with friends like these along the way.
Very good. January 15th. So I have to go to one of the most startling insights of the book. And I remember saying this about your book, Girls and Sex, too, which is that many, many parents are not having these conversations about sex and intimacy and pleasure. And they're not talking to their kids about what it means to be a thoughtful and respectful partner. Why not?
Yeah. And they're particularly not talking to boys less than girls. Well, who talked to us, Carrie? You know, there's been just
my parents
silence.
Did. Yeah.
Well, okay, you're
they're unusual.
Well, you're different. But for most people, their parents didn't talk to them. And the issue is that we live in a really different culture now. And whereas maybe you could get away with that or excuse it, we don't have the luxury of silence anymore when kids grow up in a culture where, on one hand, they are absolutely saturated with messages about transactional, commodified sexuality, of male sexual entitlement, of female sexual submission and availability that are in, you know, porn, yes, which I'm sure we'll talk about, but mainstream media as well. And then we are completely silent about talking to them about what a healthy, mutually gratifying sexual and romantic experience might look like or should look like.
You write late in the book, after nearly a decade of reporting on teenagers and sex, if I know anything for sure, it's that parents just have to get over it. And here's the other revelation. These kids want their parents to talk to them about sexual intimacy and relationships, even if they appear not to be uncomfortable about the conversation, right?
Even when they roll their eyes, even when they plug their ears, even when they run screaming from the room. Mm-hmm. And what the boys said to me, and the guys that I talked to over 100 guys between the ages of 16 and 22, all across the country, different backgrounds, different sexual orientations. And what was interesting to me about them was that they really wanted the men in their lives, their fathers or their father figures, to engage in those conversations. And particularly, they wanted to know about emotional intimacy, and they were interested in talking to their fathers about their father's own regrets. And I think that's especially hard, having those conversations for dads, because, again, you know, men, nobody talked to them. Involves emotional vulnerability, which we will discuss. And, you know, you'd rather there's no template for that for them. But it was really clear that boys wanted that conversation, and that, you know, you don't have to be perfect to have it. You don't have to know all the answers, know all the questions, get it right the first time, or even have the perfect relationship yourself in order to be able to drop some wisdom on your son.
I don't want to miss what you just said, that boys found it powerful to have their parents, maybe particularly their fathers, talk to them about maybe where they got it wrong. A relationship that didn't work out. It sure is. Yeah. Why do you think that's so powerful?
That was an unexpected thing that boys said to me. Because I think at this moment in history in particular, a lot of young men are really trying to understand the messages they're getting about consent and reciprocity and mutuality and what happens when they fall short of that. And in the public conversation, so often what we talk about is, you know, somebody who assaults is a monster and only monsters assault. And it is blinding us to having a sort of more everyday discussion about the everyday kind of, you know, coercion and misconduct even that good guys might engage in, because, you know, a good guy can do a bad thing, and trying to figure out how we can create a path to accountability for that and how men can hold other men accountable to that was a big issue in the book.
We heard from Noah in Minneapolis, who says, I'm 22. My parents never talked to me about pleasure. They pushed abstinence. I was raised in a pretty conservative household, so I was left to figure things out on my own. Now, after decades of research about how abstinence sex education is not effective, it sounds like parents and some schools are still believing that that is the way to talk about sexuality.
It's still the dominant curriculum in our culture. And we do know that, I mean, there's just endless amounts of research that shows that not only is it ineffective, but it's actually harmful, that it increases rates of pregnancy. It doesn't reduce rates of partners. It doesn't especially, it delays intercourse a little bit, not much. But those subject to its lessons are more likely to get pregnant, more likely to have disease. And what's really one thing that was really interesting to me was that pleasure-based sex education that also includes refusal skills has been shown to reduce rates of assault. Wow. This is more among girls, but abstinence only does not. And so it actually puts our kids at risk. So in a very real way, abstinence only education is ideology over public health and our children's well-being.
I know we could do an hour on this, but I just want to emphasize this with what you said. And this is what Peggy writes in the book. Decades of research have made clear that talking to children about sex does not reduce the age at which they start. Our teens are in urgent need of high-quality human development courses. Let me grab a call here from Justin in St. Paul. Justin, how does this go in your own household? Glad you called.
Yes, I have three boys, 16, 14, and 10.
Uh-huh.
And if they can ask the question, they can hear the answer. And I tell them that what's good for you is good for her, and yes means yes. And that's, you know, we're very open.
Do you wait for the questions to come to you, Justin, or have you initiated some of those conversations?
We have initiated some of those questions. It's not always comfortable, but it's important that we say, hey, do you have questions? Do you want to talk about it? When you do, we're ready to listen, and there's nothing wrong with it. Everything, you know, we keep it open dialogue going.
What do you hear in that, Peggy?
Well, you know, it's really great to hear somebody talk about reciprocity and talk about opening a dialogue with their kids. One thing I do want to bring up is that I don't want this conversation to get too narrow around, you know, specifics around sex, because one of the things that was really clear to me in talking to boys and in talking to girls is that we tend to put sex kind of in a silo away from the other aspects of our lives and away from the other aspects of being a good person and away from all these other issues. And talking about sex includes all of that. And it also includes bringing up gender dynamics, bringing up power dynamics. You know, when you talk about, you know, what's good for one person, what's good for another person, there's a lot that in our socialization that blocks those conversations from happening, or that creates assumptions that play into lowered satisfaction at one end and potential assault at the other. So thinking about media, thinking about talking to boys about connecting to their own emotion and vulnerability. In the last chapter of Boys and Sex, I talk about sort of a whole host of conversations that we might have with guys, and, you know, and it's a lot of little conversations. You know, to say the talk, you would never have one talk with your child about table manners and then think they were going to go out into the world and always remember to say thank you, you know?
Peggy Ornstein is with us. If you've just gotten in on the show, and we are talking about her new book, Boys and Sex, Young Men on Hookups, Love, Porn, Consent, and Navigating the New Masculinity. We want to hear from you this morning. Young men, 35 years and younger, I want to know if your parents talk to you about sexuality and pleasure and intimacy and relationships and gender in those relationships. How did you figure out what to believe, what to understand about this? And parents of boys and young men, do you talk to your kids about sexuality and intimacy and pleasure and relationships? As you can hear, many parents don't. You must be worried about the influence of pornography. How do you handle that? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter at CarrieNPR, where a listener says, Carrie, I'm Jim, 29, Minneapolis. My parents avoided the subject of sex entirely. They probed to know if I've gotten sex ed in school, and once they knew that I had, there was not another word on the subject. Lucky for me, I learned to navigate the subject on my own. Are too many parents relying on what is pretty skimpy sex education in schools, Peggy?
Well, it is true that skimpy would be a good word for it. So we cannot rely on that, especially on these larger messages. And, you know, one of the things that really motivated me with this book, I had not initially thought I would write about boys, that my wheelhouse was girls. And but then Me Too came along, right? And and we saw just the sheer magnitude and breadth of sexual misconduct across every sector of society. And that created a mandate to reduce sexual violence. But to me, it also created this opportunity to engage young men in these conversations about sex, about intimacy, about gender. And so, you know, going out and talking to these guys, it was really clear that they had never talked to another adult, many of them.
Blows about my mind. Wow.
About any of this. And so, you know, it was so, they were really hungry to talk, and I had not expected it. And what I really wanted to do was bring their voices forward so that parents could, you know, hear what was inside young men's heads, but also offer young men themselves something that they could look at to maybe open a more meaningful dialogue amongst themselves, or, you know, in their own mind.
Call here from Catherine in Minneapolis. Hi, Catherine.
Hi, I am wondering about what single moms do if there isn't a man in the family that can kind of help out with a more comfortable conversation.
Well, I don't know that that conversation is comfortable, you know, even if you have a man in the family. And ideally, there would be somebody in your life, you know, a friend, an uncle, somebody who can talk to your boy. But that doesn't mean that you can't, and or that you shouldn't. And one thing is that on my website, which is just my name, PeggyArnstein.com, I have a extensive list of resources for parents and for young people themselves on having those conversations and some tools for you. So I would encourage you to take a look there.
Annie says on Twitter, I have a 15-year-old son. I've had this pot of condoms in my kitchen for about 3 years. All of my son's friends know about it. I've been open with my son about sexuality since he was a toddler. To the phones to Ethan in Chaska. Ethan, you're in your early 20s. Is that right?
Yeah, 23.
Really, really glad you called. So did your parents talk to you about this?
The conversation that I can remember was only initiated when I had heard the word prostitute on an episode of Cops that I probably shouldn't have been watching. And I like came into the kitchen and said, what's a prostitute? And my dad quickly removed me from the kitchen, away from my sisters, and taught me what it meant to make love, in air quotes. And that was it. And that was probably like fifth or sixth grade. And then we never talked about it again.
And so then what happened? How did you learn, you know, about some of the issues that we're talking about this morning, sexual pleasure and intimacy and relationships?
Yeah. Thankfully, we did have a sex education in middle school. And then I would say around college, there was just a lot more conversations going on about it, especially with Me Too going on. Mm-hmm. And so through a lot of conversations with that, I think is where my understanding really developed. But I mean, that took a secondary education and, you know, not till early 20s for any of those ideas to evolve.
That seems late, right?
Right. And puts both boys and girls at risk of harm along the way is the thing, you know, that you get there. Maybe you do, maybe you don't. We see with Me Too, a lot of them never do. A lot of guys never do. But, you know, at what price to themselves and at what price to their partners? So, you know, again, it's we just have to start talking more openly, and not just about the issues of risk and danger, but also having larger conversations that include personal responsibility and include joy.
Let me come back to something you alluded to a little earlier, Peggy, which is this idea about how the idea of consent has changed on college campuses, even from the time that you were talking to girls on college campuses about sexuality. What did you hear from boys about it?
Well, most boys do now, like Ethan, they have had some education, at least at the college level, to understand the concept, the basic concept of consent. At the same time, in the hookup culture that a lot of kids find themselves in, being intoxicated or high is Lisa Wade, who's a sociologist in California, calls it. It creates the compulsory carelessness necessary to have a hookup.
Wow.
Because you know it reduces that fanatic generational fear of the awkward, and you have to have a certain level of anesthetization in order to do that, because as one of the boys said to me, who had had multiple partners, you know, it's a weird thing. You don't make a lot of eye contact. Maybe there's not a lot of conversation. You're acting vulnerable, but you're not being vulnerable with someone that you don't know or care about very much. And, you know, it's kind of weird and not even really very fun. But that drunken piece means that you need to find somebody who is drunk enough to say yes, and yourself have to be drunk enough to want to say yes, but not so drunk that they can't say yes. And that can be, you know, and who is to be the judge of that? And then on top of that, you have no conversation and no education. Things start to go off the rails. And guys are kind of, and why I talk about male socialization a lot is that boys kind of learn left unchecked to put their pleasure before women's feelings. When they're drunk particularly, they overperceive. Yes, they can see any friendliness in a girl as a come on. They're less likely to hear no, less likely to notice a partner's hesitation, less likely to step in as bystanders. So we really need to talk to our boys not only about, you know, the larger issues of sex itself, but about the context and the dynamics that can cause them to cause harm, even when maybe they don't mean to.
You know, again, our discussion about pornography is coming here, but, you know, mm-hmm. in listening to what you've just said and remembering a discussion about your research with girls and sex, this thing of performance really yeah. seems to rise, right? That I am performing for the gaze of what, a partner, the culture? I mean,
the invisible audience.
From? Is that it?
yeah, I mean, and so if you're talking about hookup culture in particular,
yeah.
you know, one of the guys said to me, you know, a lot of the guys said that what it's really about is the story you're telling to your friends when you go back to your friends, right? It's about impressing your guys. So as one guy said, you know, maybe that you want to impress your guys, so maybe you're going to be a little dominating. Maybe you're going to push because the girl's there for, as a means for you to get off and brag. That's what you learn from your friends. So there's a sort of a story that I tell about a hookup that goes bad for this boy, and the girl goes back, you know, to tell her friends and says that he was, you know, his nails were ragged, he was bad, this and that. And it was interesting because you expect girls to be, you know, we know about slut shaming with girls.
Yeah.
He was shamed in that same way and really kind of spiraled around it. So it took him a while to sort of come to terms with what he wanted and didn't want coming out of that experience. But it was pretty interesting. But yes, there's an invisible audience in the room for both boys and girls. Another thing a boy said to me was that boys do think about girls' satisfaction, but they don't measure it maybe the way women might measure it. They measure it through stamina. I don't know what I can say on the radio.
Yeah.
let's just leave it there.
Got
best
it.
Stamina. And so one boy said to me that, he would look at the clock before he would start intercourse when he was younger, and that, you know, he would want to make sure that he, you know, hit his mark because, not for the girl, even not for her satisfaction per se, but so that when she went back to her friends,
yeah.
he would know that he could feel pride and that she would, you know, tell a good story.
Call from Morgan in Minneapolis. Hey, Morgan, how old are you?
I am 24.
I'm glad you called. So what are you thinking about?
So I think these discussions are super important to have. And the insight I want to provide is, you know, as my age cohort, I mean, I've had a smartphone since middle school. And even I feel like the most progressive parents that foster the best dialogues with their children, oftentimes Googling something is a little less embarrassing than going to your parents and, you know, hey, Dad, I know you said I can ask you anything, but... And I think it's kind of a fact that isn't really brought up too often, partly, I think, because of comfort. No
yeah,
one wants...
That makes sense.
...children Googling things like these on the school bus on the way home. But I do think there's positives in terms of the resources that are available online. And especially in, say, school districts that don't really have as much of a comprehensive program as you've discussed during this program, this radio program, I think that online resources can kind of fill in that void.
Yeah, that, you know, that's such a good point because, you know, the internet can give and the internet can take. there are some fantastic resources for young people. Scarlet Teen is really great. Sex, etc. is really great. For middle school, there's amaze.org is fantastic. And those, again, you can find those on my resource page at peggyornstein.com. The flip side, of course, is you start Googling stuff on the internet and a whole lot of inappropriate is going to come at you. Which I don't know if you want to segue into the porn conversation.
I want to grab one more call, but we're headed for porn here. To Leslie, I think somebody you'll know, Peggy, on the phone line here.
Hey, Peg.
My sister-in-law. Hi.
Hi. So I just wanted to say that it's such a good conversation, and having three kids, and Peggy, you being such a wonderful aunt to, you know, talk to our kids. I mean, it's true. I just had to say it because I think that it's not just parents having conversations with their kids, but it's also, you know, other family members, if they feel comfortable and close, as you did, it being very valuable.
Leslie, I just want to ask you
crying
this.
A little bit now.
Leslie, so if Peggy didn't have this kind of comfort level with this, what would you do? How would you handle this with three kids?
Well, I mean, I think I reached out to a lot of other parents, my friends. I know my dad, when I was 15, was like, Leslie, we're going to go to Planned Parenthood. You're going to learn these things. So I have and have had other resources, and I feel like my husband, Peggy's brother, was also very, I mean, just supportive. But I think it really helps to open it up to, you know, there's just so many gaps to fill in. And sometimes, as wonderful as a parent is, you know, you think you are, your kids are, as Peggy said, rolling their eyes like, oh, Mom, stop now. But, you know, I think school districts also play an important part. I remember our school district would have conversations that parents could do with their kids at the dinner table. Mm-hmm. And so it's just a lot of different things. But I have to say, she's a great aunt.
and a wonderful sister-in-law. Thank you, love. I do want to say one thing about that I did talk to my nieces and nephews, and we talk so much about these conversations being awkward and excruciating, but my nieces and nephews are now adults, and part of having those conversations was that it deepened our relationship and that I got to show up for them, and it created a kind of scaffolding to the adult relationship we have now. And my nieces and nephews and I are super close, and I love them so much, and we text and we talk. I'm going to see them when I'm in their cities, and I really think it's because, you know, I took the risk and I you know, had that vulnerability and engaged in those conversations with them.
Peggy Ornstein on the show this morning with her new book, Boys and Sex, Young Men on Hookups, Love, Porn, Consent, and Navigating the New Masculinity. And yes, after we get the latest news, we're talking about pornography. Here is something that stood out for me in what Peggy has written about pornography. There's a researcher at Indiana University who's looked at this. His name is Brian Paul. And one of the findings is that pornography is drenched in so much casual aggression that young adults really stop noticing that. Think about the implications of that. And then think about your kids being exposed to pornography and that kind of casual aggression at a young, really formative age. So we'll talk about that and the other consequences of so much such accessible pornography online and your calls and questions and your experiences with this. Have you talked to your kids? Have you talked to your young boys about this and your young girls in your household? Are you struggling to find a way in? Young men in the audience, I want to hear about what your parents said to you about this, and I want to hear about the effect of such accessibility to pornography. Is that where you really learned about sexual intimacy and pleasure? I'm gonna grab a call here, and then Peggy and I are going to talk about the effect of pornography to Connor in Duluth. Hi, Connor. Thanks so much for waiting.
Yeah, not a problem.
What's your story on this? What do you think
about? I just, no one had really interjected up to this point. And my parents were very Christian and religious growing up. And, you know, my dad did have kind of the birds and the bees conversation with me. I understood how it worked. But the stance from there was really one of total abstinence. There was never really conversations about consent, building relationships, and things like that. So, I mean, it was kind of a difficult spot to be in, especially in middle and high school.
I'll bet. Yeah.
Right. And it leaves you really ill-equipped to know how to make those bridges to form the kind of mutually gratifying, sustainable relationships that you want to form as well. You know, even if you are an abstinence-forward parent, which, you know, abstinence is a legit choice if it's not presented as a mandate, and if you're not comparing people who are sexually active to chewed pieces of gum, which is what abstinence-only curriculum does. You still are living in a world where you're exposed to a lot of messages around, a lot of negative messages around sex, where you need to know about consent, where you need to know how to form relationships. Whenever that's going to happen to you, we still need to have those conversations with young people.
Connor, you're in your early 30s, is that right?
Correct.
Yeah. I'm wondering, so I don't know if the pornography online was as accessible for you as it is now, but not having a lot of, you know, information from your parents, were there times when you were kind of seeking information on those sites?
Absolutely. I would say that was pretty much a primary source of information and learning, which is obviously not ideal.
Right.
That's it. Both statistically and in among the boys that I talked to for Boys and Sex, pornography, when parents don't say anything, when schools don't say anything, in the world we live in, pornography becomes the de facto sex educator.
I remember you talking about this, Peggy, when we talked about girls and sex, that if the girls were seeing the effects of pornography through the expectations that boys were bringing into relationships and intimate encounters. Remind me again about what girls saw about that and then what's happening with boys.
Well, and also girls look to porn themselves as a manual of what they think boys' expectations are. Huh. So, you know, I want to back up one step and say a couple things. You know, curiosity about sex is normal. Masturbation, you know, yay, very good. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of different kinds of porn. You know, there's ethical porn, there's feminist porn, there's queer porn, there's all these porns. But what is different now, because of smartphones, because of the internet, and because in 2007, places like Pornhub dropped the paywall. So now, newly, kids can see anything that you can imagine and, you know, frankly, a whole lot of things that nobody wants to imagine right at their fingertips, 24/7. And that's what's different. And that kind of pornography that they're looking at typically presents a very distorted idea of sex as something men do to women, not with women. Mm-hmm. It presents female pleasure as a performance for male satisfaction and, you know, wildly inaccurately. Bodies are inaccurate. There's never connection. There's not sensuality. There's not consent. You know, there's not playfulness. There's all these things. And when we don't get in there and talk to young people about what's real and what's not real and what's missing, then yes, they bring these ideas into the bedroom. They don't have any other context.
And I want to emphasize something that I talked about before we went to news, which is this research that comes out from this researcher at Indiana University. I just found this really disturbing that this casual aggression is such a part of the pornographic performance. The kids start to think that is really the way it happens and that's what's necessary.
Yeah, so by casual aggression, they're talking about slapping, spitting, name-calling of names that we won't say. And so when they have like light, what they call it, light aggression and high sexual activity, kids don't, they would give students a list of aggressive things. They knew that they thought that these things were aggressive. Mm-hmm. They'd show them the clips. They'd say, which of these things did you see? And they would say, none of them. Wow. And then they tried saying, well, okay, did you see this? And they knew these things were in the clips, and the kids would just say, no. And so there's different things could be read in, you could have different conclusions. One could be that's not what they're there for. They don't see it. Therefore it's no problem. That would be great for the porn industry, I suppose. More likely, it's creating, unconscious expectations, what they call media primes, in the ways that media creates our expectations, even when we don't want it to, even when we don't think it will, and affects our thoughts, feelings, and beliefs, and creates a sort of prime of saying, light aggression is acceptable, light aggression is okay, light aggression is, or some level of aggression is desirable, and creates the prime so that, if you're in a bar and somebody whacks into somebody, a woman whacks into you, and the person turns around and says, something vile to her, that seems normal. That's okay.
Call from Douglas in Minneapolis. Hi, Douglas.
Hi there. How are you?
I'm well, and I'm glad you called. What's your own experience with this?
Yeah, so I'm a 23-year-old guy, and I was lucky enough to be raised in a really sexually progressive household.
Mm-hmm.
So in addition to conversations about sex and relationships and pleasure, we also, my parents and I, discussed pornography. And they instilled in me the understanding that porn was a fiction, which I think was a really important way to keep me from understanding those values or those expressions as real, right? The same way a violent movie or a violent video game is, if it's educated correctly, wouldn't force somebody or wouldn't instill those values necessarily in someone.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was a super important thing for me, was to have those conversations with my parents and for them to say, yes, this is what you'll see.
Mm-hmm.
These are the behaviors you'll see if you watch these things, but that's not real. That's not what real sex with real people looks like or feels like.
Peggy,
I think that was really important for
Douglas,
me.
Hang on for just a sec. Peggy, how does that sound?
I think that's a start, and I think that we have to help boys understand the difference between, for instance, something that's super arousing versus something that's pleasurable.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, we have to look at some of the gender dynamics in porn. We do know that guys, there's research that shows that college guys who are regular porn users report less satisfaction with their partnered interactions, with their own bodies, with their partner's bodies, with the quality of what happens. And I think, also helping boys understanding some issues that are more, a little more theoretical, but that sometimes something, porn tends to, play on getting more and more aggressive over time to get eyeballs, get attention in this, attention economy. And there's a way that when something is simultaneously kind of offensive or disturbing and super sexual,
mm-hmm.
that it actually can turbocharge arousal in a way that, like, if I said, don't think of a bear, now you're thinking of a bear, that it's simultaneous. Embedded in the message of don't is also the message of do, and the brain works so that it turbocharges you on that. So helping boys also understand the difference, between arousal and pleasure, between a physiological response and what's actually liked and wanted. There's a whole chapter on porn and boys and sex, and I really wanted it to help parents with the conversation, but also provide boys with a lot of insight, because it was really, when I was talking to boys, it was one of the number one things they wanted to discuss with me.
So, Douglas, given what Peggy just said about that and you being in your early 20s, is this something that you and your guy friends talk about? Is it something that you and your girlfriends or the girls that you hang out with talk about?
Funny enough, I actually talk about it more with my girlfriend and my previous girlfriends than I ever have with my guy friends.
Huh.
So basically, for the current relationship that I'm in, consumption of porn is not stigmatized between the two of us. We mm-hmm. understand what it is, and we understand that, just like any other media, careful consumption to fulfill a certain need is acceptable,
mm-hmm.
But it doesn't interfere with our relationship and our sort of pleasure and happiness together. But that's because we had very intentional conversations about it a long time ago.
Sounds really.
I was just going to say, it sounds like you have a lot of really intentional conversation, which is really wonderful. I also want to say that we are, you know, this new concern about porn is important, and we do need to help kids have a sense of media literacy and a critique around porn. But mainstream media, you know, we get a lot of ideas about sex from mainstream media that are just as skewed, that also have those messages of, you know, transactional sexuality, male sexual entitlement, female sexual availability. And we need to get in there with that, too. One boy said to me that he thought music was a big factor in how guys treat girls. And he said, you know, you're driving around with your guys in the car and you're hearing, I can't say this, what he told me on the radio, but let's just say hit it and quit it. Mm-hmm. You know, 4, 5, 10 times a day, it's going to affect your mindset. So talking to guys also about not just porn, but as we do with girls, we've done a much better job with girls of creating a sense of media literacy and critique, because we know that those messages are harmful to them and harmful to their body image and harmful to their sense of self. But we've let boys grow up and steep in the same culture without saying anything.
You know, one of the other revelations for me were the conversations that you had with transgender kids and queer kids. And you say they provided a unique perspective on masculinity, including the discussions you were having about consent. They were, these kids understood that better. They were more comfortable with it. Now, why?
Yeah, that was really fascinating. Gay boys especially were real models of, not to say that there was never miscommunication or there was never trauma or anything like that, but they were models of how to negotiate consent and navigate kind of the parameters of a sexual relationship, kind of because they had to be, you know, because what was going to happen and who was going to do what with whom and how was not necessarily readily apparent. So one of the gay boys that I talked to said, I don't get straight guys' resistance to having this consent conversation. I mean, when we have this conversation, it means we're going to have sex, and that's great. So, you know, Dan Savage uses the, who's a sex columnist, uses the phrase, says the phrase, the four magic words that gay guys will say at the beginning of an encounter are, "What are you into?" And I loved that because it was such an open-ended question, as opposed to how we so often talk about consent, which is sort of a set of prescriptive questions that make assumptions that you can say yes or no to, that one person is asking the other.
It is open-ended, isn't it? And it does, it signals to the other person, there is going to be some kind of sexual activity. Now let's talk about what it's going to be.
Yeah, let's create a mutually gratifying experience for both of us. What is that, a creative experience? What is that going to look like? And I know, you know, a lot of adults can't do that. Gay men seem to be better at doing it. I've also thought about the fact that, given what I wrote about in Girls and Sex, if you, and the ways that girls are cut off from their desires and their responses, if a boy were to say that to a heterosexual girl, her response might be, "I have no idea whatsoever." You know, and so thinking about, you know, there's still these dynamics at play, but what if kids could have those conversations? What if all of us could have those conversations? And how do we get there?
Listener on Twitter, I have 18-year-old twins, boy and girl. Sex is an important conversation. I stress that if they think it's awkward and uncomfortable with me, it's nothing compared to a doctor, partner, or parents of a girlfriend, boyfriend. Boy, good note. To Brett.
Great note.
To Brett in Lake Park. Hi, Brett. Really appreciate you hanging on. I know it's been a while.
Hey, no, that's not a problem. What I wanted to bring to my conversation was my conversation with my mother. She was a seller of adult products at one point in my life. And I was about 13 at the time, and me and a friend of mine had fallen the sash. She found us playing with these things, like, you know, we had them out playing like they were lightsabers and whatnot. And she sat down and had a very good conversation with us about the use of these things, like for pleasure, and, you know, that sex just wasn't sex. It was love, making, pleasure, all of this. And then she gave me avenues after that on how to research what all of that means to me in my sexual life. And it helped me to get to a better place on all of the product or stuff we're talking about today.
Yes.
Or you guys are talking about today.
Sounds like a good opportunity there.
That's amazing. And I kept thinking as I talked to boys around the country and we would have these conversations and they would say to me, you know, that they had never had this like protected space to have a conversation like this. And they would say, they said things they never told anybody before, or they would, that something had, you know, they'd really made some revelation or had therapeutic value to them. And I kept thinking, I am a total stranger. I am a total stranger to these boys. What if they could talk to adults in their lives or to one another and have the kinds of conversation that the caller just described?
You're also a very, very good listener, Peggy. Don't underestimate the power of full attention. No, really.
Yeah.
Right?
It is. Thank you. But I think that that's true, too, when people always will ask me, how did I get them to talk? And the truth is, I listen and I learned it, and I think the trick, if there was one, was to learn to listen non-judgmentally and openly and with curiosity, which can be hard to do as a parent. I'm a parent of a teenager too, but I think that that's when early on when I was interviewing girls, I would betray on my face, I think, shock or surprise or kind of, you know, I don't know what, and it would shut them down immediately. So I had to learn to really not just be able to ask the questions, but be able to really listen open-heartedly to their responses.
Oh, that's good. A call here from Carrie in Moorhead, Minnesota. Hi, Carrie.
Hi. I just wanted to share, my husband was very proactive, and in middle school, he actually found a video. It was a very comic video about the effect of porn on boys' brains. And he sat us all down to watch it together, which was incredibly awkward and funny. And then we actually ended up coining that phrase, that anytime our kids wanted to have a conversation, we could all enter into it knowing it was going to be the funny, awkward conversation.
Oh, good.
That's basically the title of it. And it continues. Now our kids are in their 20s, and we still invite, hey, you know, we're in the car for a couple of hours. Any funny, awkward questions?
That's good.
It's healthy.
I love that. And I love that you brought up the car, because that's always one of my big tips is talk to them in the car. A, they can't escape. B, you don't have to make eye contact. It's, you know, it actually really helps.
Peggy, just a couple of the resources again that were mentioned. You said Sex Etc., Scarlet Teen.
Scarlet Teen. They're all on my website, which is probably easier. My name, PeggyOrenstein.com, under resources. And Amaze.org is great for middle school kids. And there's a book, the two books that I say are Shafia Zaloom's Sex, Teens, and Everything in Between, and Heather Carina's book, SEX, are great for families of teens.
Peggy will be here on January 15th, and I will tweet out a link to her appearance. But Peggy, always, always a pleasure. Thank you much.
Right back at you.
Peggy Ornstein's book is called Boys and Sex, and you'll find some links and some further educational places to go on my Twitter feed at CarrieMPR. Let's talk about sex. About sex for now, to the people at home or in the crowd, it keeps coming up anyhow. Don't be coy, avoid or make void the topic, cause that ain't gonna stop it. Now we talk about sex on the radio and video shows. Many will know anything goes. Let's tell it like it is and how it could be, how it was, and of course how it should be. Those who think it's dirty have a choice: pick up the needle, press pause, or turn the radio off. Will that stop us, Pep? I doubt it. All right then, come on, spin. Let's talk about sex, baby. Let's talk about you.
You just heard a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to the discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet us at CarrieMPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all our shows by subscribing to this podcast. You can send us your questions or comments by emailing talk@npr.org.